Welcome back, everyone. That was an awfully efficient and quick settling in. Thank you very much. Our next panel is, Manuel, who are you? I'm Theo Rosenfelder. I have worked with a number of different collectives all up and down the West Coast. My name tag stuck on my pants here says Pala Community Development. I have a small company that I work with a couple of other people around in the audience doing community organizing work, both in underground communities as well as in more established nonprofit organizations and such. This next panel has a kind of cumbersome name of Community Dynamics of Dynamic Communities. And speaking with me here is Ghouli and Ethan, who I'll let introduce themselves as they come up. First, we're going to be hearing from Ghouli about some theoretical as well as concrete tools that communities can use to organize themselves. And then when we hear from Ethan, we'll have some of I'll just wait to introduce you when it's your time, because I'm blanking right now. So over to Ghouli.
Hi. How does this thing work? Oh, right. Woo! All right. Hi, my name's Ghouli. I guess a little bit about me. Burning Man, SF Raves, yada, yada, yada. You've heard it all before. I basically first got involved basically with friends and family in the 90s or so, and then branched out to Cloud Factory. And I've done a lot of staffing coordination for both of those groups and event coordination stuff. So I work with Ethan and Scott very closely, as well as a bunch of other people. So I've had a chance to take a pretty close look at group dynamics, and then another important influence of mine has actually been open source communities, which Brian Billendorf is going to be talking a lot about later on today. Without further ado, and pardon me if I refer to my notes quite a bit, but I guess first I'd like to talk about a little bit about that how one deals with communities of people whose primary motivation for work is the joy of doing work with the individuals involved. When I talk about work throughout my section here, what I'm really talking about is what we get together to do, which mainly has to do with music, the dancing, and the organizing that we do to bring these things together in the art. So I think first I'd like to go over a couple definitions of transparency and meritocracy. So transparency is the degree, as I'm defining it, is the degree to which a group's communications and processes are available to be seen and reviewed by all members of the community. This is a general philosophy that, as I've seen, a lot of the groups that I've worked with contributes a lot to the sustainability of that community. Examples of transparency are, for example, when a group will post the budget, a party's budget on a mailing list, or have meetings beforehand and have minutes taken of those meetings and posted to a list so that they can be reviewed by the greater community. A lack of transparency will often result in divisive and surprising things. Surprises tend to be bad things in communities. They're when expectations haven't been managed very well, and I guess as a concrete example of that, is a while at one of the friends and family parties that we had, we started having food being done. And for a couple years, there was a group of people that really enjoyed contributing by creating the menus and cooking for people and serving. And this one particular year, we had a different, and that had definitely been a rotational thing from year to year. And one year we had one particular individual do it, and the way that he had decided to do it was, well, I guess let me first go over the way that we had traditionally done it, where I've been staffing coordinator, and we have this staffing sheet that I'll talk a little bit more about a little later. But basically what the staffing sheet enables the community to do is it's a web page that enables people to sign up for various staffing shifts so that people know when they're supposed to be working and who they're supposed to be working for. And as staffing coordinator, I would have a number of coordinators, like a food coordinator and a door coordinator, and they would tell me what they need. My function was to facilitate staff for all the coordinators. And in years past, the way that we had done it is there would be one particular, the magic day, when I would post the staffing sheet, and then everyone would gang up on the staffing sheet and sign it up, and it's actually a pretty beautiful sight to behold, because within, you know, oftentimes a couple hours, over 150 shifts would be 80% filled. It would just be done. And so traditionally, all of those had been posted at once. And this is actually a pretty concrete example of the transparency issue that I was talking about earlier, where everybody knows basically what's going on to a certain degree, and you can include... and people feel included. But the way that it happened this one particular year, and which resulted in a bit of a minor row, wasn't very major, but this particular coordinator had decided that that he was going to fill all of his spaces beforehand, so which was, there certainly weren't any rules against anything like that, but so what this person did is they sent me a completed, filled-out section of all of the people that were going to be working for him and when. So when I actually posted the staff sheet, that section was already filled out. So when I posted this, I got quite a few emails from people who had traditionally helped with this in years past, and they were upset. They were surprised. They had been looking forward to signing up for a food slot, but it looked like they were all signed up already. And this is a pretty, I hope, a relatively concrete example of a lack of transparency, where the hive mind, wasn't able to see what was going on. And this person had actually, a couple of weeks prior, had sent out a single email before saying, like, hey, I want to include everybody, so if you're interested, send me some email. And a couple people had, but, a single piece of email can be difficult in a planner's list where, at the height of planning, you're getting an incredible volume of email. So it all worked out fine in the end, of course, as these things always do. And the people, pretty much anybody that wanted to work food was able to, but... this is an example of sort of the lack of transparency. Let's see. The transparency really allows is peer review, And peer review is the ability for people to go over what's being done and offer their ideas on ways that it could be done better, or just reviewing it. But another really important concept that counters peer review is, and something that I hope that you'll hear more of, is that people that do, those who do the work are entitled to more say and more influence over those that aren't doing the work. And as we're planning stuff online, I'll often see, like, you know, you get the torrent of emails and comments from the Peanut Gallery, and I'm not trying to discount what anybody has to say, and I think it's very important to listen to everything, because you never know where you're going to get a good comment or who's going to come up with the thing that, like, an important thing that you forgot. However, when Ethan made one of the comments about it feeling ponderous and bureaucratic, it can be easy to get stuck in, like, feeling like you have to listen and do something about every single comment that goes by. And this comment that if you are doing the work, you have more say than those that are not, can kind of help get things unstuck, because it's just like, well, this is the way, you know, I'm coordinating the door, and this is the way it's going to happen this time. And if there are problems with it, we'll figure it out, and it always works out. So meritocracy, literally, is a system in which the talented are chosen and moved ahead on the basis of achievement. I know this is a little bit of a heavy definition, but in the groups that we're talking about here, I like to think of moving ahead is more increased responsibility and trust on the pace of the place of the group. And talent is defined as what you've done in the past and how well you've done it. And what we're trying to address here are people getting over their head. We've all been at, you know, parties where someone has agreed to do something and either they don't do it at all, they disappear, they flake, or it gets done in not exactly the best way and somebody has to either come in and redo it, or it just sort of lays festering all night and people are unhappy about it. When within an active dynamic group, if you have this idea of meritocracy in mind, what it often leads to is that people that want to help are given lower responsibility but still important things to do, whether that's a cleanup committee or doing a door shift. I don't mean to imply that cleanup committee isn't important, but no buts at all. Cleanup is, like, one of the most very important things. But when you see somebody who's consistently made, like, who has consistently come through and helping to clean up or moving speakers around, you know that you can count. They have a track record. You know who they are. You know that they're reliable. You know that if they then want to, you know, coordinate the door or coordinate actually, like, getting all the trash people together, they're going to follow through. So this is a concept that we can use to try and sort out who's doing what. Up to the most important stuff, like budget coordination and staff coordination and the coordination of the whole thing. So let's see. And I guess an associated concept I wanted to mention real quickly is ownership. And this whole transparency meritocracy thing really facilitates group members having a sense of ownership, and that sense of ownership leads to an associated sense of belonging. This is what we're all after. People contribute to parties and they contribute to events so that they can feel like they're as much a part of it. We all know that you can only go to parties, you can only go to events as a spectator for so long before it gets boring. Either you get involved and you contribute somehow and you become actually a part of the community, or you drop out and you go do something else. And that's what our communities, that's one of the commonalities that our communities are all about. I'd like to quickly go over a couple tools that we've developed, and that one in particular that we've developed and that I know a lot of other communities, other stuff that we've all used. But I think that the most important tool outside of anything technological is creating within the communities that you're involved with a living philosophy of these concepts. And it's the intent. Because if you do not have the intent to be transparent or the intent to do these things, no one's going to use them, the tools, or they'll be used half-assedly and are almost worse than nothing. So with that being said, some of the tools that we use that are common is, of course, meetings. But with the intent of transparency, it's very important to take meetings, minutes at these meetings, and have them posted in some way that that can be accessed by people who aren't able to be there, because everybody is never able to be there. And when the group is aware that someone's actually going to be taking notes and doing stuff with this, it takes a lot of the stress out of 50 people feeling like they all have to be there if they want to really contribute. Another thing, of course, are mailing lists. But again, with the idea of transparency, I feel that a mailing list is not enough. You need a mailing list that has an archive as well, so that people can search and look and see what's happened and catch up on discussions. This is critically important for both newbies who want to know what kind of culture they're getting into and how decisions are being made, as well as to longstanding members, so that you can disappear for a week and catch up on a particular subject if you haven't been around. Let's see. And I talked about a staffing sheet that we had developed for when I was originally staffing coordinator. It was simply an overwhelming job, because you were basically sending out an email to, you know, sometimes hundreds of people saying, okay, what shift do you want? You know, and you'd get email back, and then people change their mind and they want to work with their friend and blah, 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 and it would become this full-time job for weeks. And it just wasn't sustainable and was driving me crazy. So with the help of some friends, we developed this thing called a staffing sheet. And Ivan, actually, who's here. Ivan, are you here? Want to wiggle your hand? He's in the other room. All right. Well, Ivan was very important in helping to get this off the ground. And in fact, the staffing sheet documentation and binaries are hosted on his site, 420.am. Basically, the staffing sheet allows you to create these things where you can get your staffing all done, and then you just release the staffing sheet, and it magically fills up. Or it doesn't, as the case may be. But at least you know exactly what's going on, and you can harangue people instead of disjointedly. You can basically go to the staffing sheet, look, we still need people for this amount of time, and you can get a real good sense of what's going on. And finally, of course, there's HTML and the web, and creating small targeted web pages for project management stuff, and also very importantly, contact. JD? So it's this permanence that the staffing sheet and mailing list with archives and meetings with minutes affords to a group that really add to community sustainability. How these things all add to sustainability is, I don't have much time left, so these things make it easy. Things can just come together. We've all had, and not that you need any of these things in particular to have that feeling, but that to me is one of the indicative qualities of having like a good solid community group, is that things seem easy and they just sort of like come together. They contribute to a common sense of pride over the work that you're doing and your accomplishments. It's more fun because you can try and get out of the process and just get into making progress. And also very importantly, this whole transparency thing allows the group to create similar expectations across the group that lead to a group sense of accomplishment. Because if you have you're coming into it with multiple different expectations, it's very difficult to come to a consensus on if it's been a success or not. So I think that's about it for now. And oh, I've got 2 minutes. Let's see. I think I'll just say a little story about, as far as these tools are concerned. My friend, old Greg Polino, who's an old FNF guy, when I was once in the throes of putting together a staffing sheet, told me that technology is not your friend. And what he meant by this is that with all the technology in the world, this is similar to the point I was making about intent earlier, but all these tools are worthless unless there is an intent on what they are to accomplish. And I guess the only other thing I wanna mention is that I know it feels like this whole meritocracy thing is not about creating an environment for a whole group of overachievers to come in and spew, you know, their ego all over the place. And while, you know, especially one of the hallmarks of friends and family is definitely overachievement, one of the things I was always impressed with FNF about is not necessarily the lack of ego, because I've often said it's not your ego, it's what you do with it. And people aren't afraid to put themselves out there and to try and contribute to the community in their best of ability, but it is about the community first. It's not about you. And so within that context, that's where the meritocracy part exists. It's just in trying to get the right people to do the right kind of jobs. So
thank you. There will be a little bit of time after Ethan and I speak for Q&A for the whole panel, but just in case there's anybody who's dying to add something or ask something of Julie's presentation, I've got a few moments now for one or two questions. Are there any hands? Shoot.
Please.
Yeah, that's basically, at least in the FNF model. I mean, there's all different kinds of groups, and they have different structures. But within FNF, the way that we've done it, we call them coordinators, but I think it's the same thing. So your door coordinator or your decorations coordinator is basically in charge of getting their whole team together, and that happened because when back in the day, when parties were a couple hundred people, you could have a staffing coordinator. Period. That was like in charge of everything. But when you've got a party of 800 people, and you know the number of door staff alone is 50 or 60, the staffing coordinator can't do it all. And the additional thing that this affords is this: you get more people involved. The door coordinator and the will call coordinator are very critically important positions, and they have to be done well. And by getting people who feel this sense of responsibility, they know that they've contributed significantly to the party, and that's extremely beneficial. So yes, we do have. It's a long one.
Can I just add some detail? I'm not sure I totally agree with that answer, in that I would say that the coordinators are responsible for kind of setting mini policy within their kind of area of responsibility and kind of moving the process forward. But they don't actually staff. Staff those slots. For instance, the staffing sheet includes all the door slots.
Right, that's correct. But basically, right. the door coordinator, for example, will tell, if I'm the staffing coordinator, would tell me I need two people for this amount of time, blah blah blah. So they'll tell me how many people they need, and then I'll create that sign up matrix within the staffing sheet, and then when people get turned loose on the staffing sheet, it fills up. But they are responsible. I'm not responsible for they're the ones that are primarily responsible for making sure that all those are filled. So they made, they're personally responsible for, you know, hey, we need some more door slots filled, you know, so.
Right, and or for at times exercising some judgment about whether or not the people that end up in those slots have what it takes to deliver on those responsibilities. For instance, we have some very important slots we call site coordinator, which are kind of who's in charge at any given moment during the course of a weekend-long party or something. And so over time, you know, that's a very important position. So some, you know, people are often kind of grandfathered into the primary responsibility for site coordinators. And there's assistant site coordinators who are kind of, you know, site coordinators in training. So there is some kind of, you know, the coordinators have the ability to kind of say, okay, you know, that person's always high at 2 in the morning, so, you know, let's put them in a different slot.
Right. And that's actually, that's a really good example of an exception to the rule. I tend to, within the big parties, I don't allow site coordinator to be a sign-up slot. I choose them, personally, because it's just too important. Like, at 2 in the morning, if there's a medical emergency and no one else is around, I have to know that the site coordinator is going to come through and isn't going to be fucked up or isn't going to be in their tent or is, you know, takes their job absolutely stone cold seriously. And the whole reason why I can know that about people is because, again, of this track record, because I'm aware of people and what they've done in the past or what they haven't done in the past.
You had a question?
I had a question about what qualities.
It's a complicated question. There's definitely a lot of traits. I mean, I can throw out some things, and one of the most important ones is a lack of ego. Is like, and people self-select towards those people. You know, no matter how much a relatively egotistical person wants to, you know, be a leader within our groups, they just don't get anywhere. You know, one of the things that I think about, I've seen repeatedly, is a phrase I actually learned in a business that I co-founded a while ago, which is that corporate culture is derived from the top, and the type of people that are involved in the top, it attracts the same kind of people. I've seen it again and again and again. And so in a group like Friends and Family or Cloud Factory, the people that tend to be in the very small handful core people attract those similar kinds of people. And we probably all know of organizations that have less than stellar people who are actually in charge and however they do it, and they tend to attract a different group of people who are involved. And you quickly find out, you know, what kind of group that you want to be involved in. So I don't know if I'm really answering your question, but it is, I think a lack of ego. I think an ability to deal with people on an individual as well as a group basis. Definitely one of the characteristics I look for in site coordinators is someone who knows and is known. That is, who knows a wide group of people within the community and is known by a wide group of people within the community. That's absolutely crucial to having people listen to you, because another trait is that somebody who isn't known to the community can say something and nobody hears them, and then somebody who is well known to the community can say the exact same thing and it's heard. It's not fair, it's not, you know, necessarily right, but until you've earned people's, like, through your track record, that's kind of the way it is. And consistency, you know, people have a lot of respect for consistency, and in groups that are notorious for being flaky and for not following through, you know, there's things you can be flaky on and there's things that you can't if you, you know, it's very important to people. So that's another. Ethan?
I was actually going to speak on this a little bit later, so I don't want to steal my own thunder too much. Communication, I think, is really important. I think you know, one of the things that I try and do when I'm organizing parties is just try and keep providing information to the group. The insurance was paid for. The gear has been reserved. it's this transparency thing again. Yeah, it's like, you know, it's just like letting everybody know how it's going, what's been accomplished, what needs to be done. It's very much just, you know, kind of facilitating and keeping the information flowing. The point I'm going to try and speak a little bit about later is I'm really of the opinion of late that our communities need to train and develop leaders. That we really need distributed leadership, and that I'm getting ahead of myself here, but that, you know, we really kind of need to look for those qualities in people and encourage it and put them out there and, you know, let them go and actually kind of really actively develop more leadership.
One of the things I've noticed, to throw my two cents in on this too, is that there are two different ways that people occupy, of course there's more than two, but to break it down, two different ways people can occupy a leadership position. One is people who want that position. They want to be a leader in a group of people. And the other is the people that just sort of look around them to see what needs to be done and then do that. And sometimes what needs to be done is something that we would call a leadership role or leadership type activity. And people, the people who are just trying to get done what needs to be done can step into the position of leader, do that because it's what needed, and then step back out hoping that someone else is going to step into that position sooner or later. And they don't step into it because they see themselves as occupying that role in a larger sense or over time, whereas the people who seek out being in that role because they think that that position is something special or that they are something special and deserve to be noticed as a leader tend to, in the long run, have wrapped their own identity up into the leadership more and therefore start making the type of mistakes that we all try to avoid in having a leader in a group of people that are all sort of naturally independent and leader-like in their own right.
One thing I've seen again and again is leadership transcends the activity. You have leadership in cleanup, you know. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that I've always seen about Scott is that at the end of a party, Scott is always the first person who starts cleaning up after the party, you know, and that's something that that really struck me from the beginning. And the other thing that I actually wanted to add really quickly is that one of the primary things that the transparency affords is that playing politics is very difficult in a transparent environment. Lack of transparency is often identifiable by a tremendous amount of politics. So, that too.
Now, in the interest of transparency, I'll let you all know that this panel started 10 minutes late. It was scheduled to end at 1 o'clock. There's about 50 minutes left in it before we are going to be turning you all loose for lunch. Ethan is going to speak about some of what goes into forming communities and maintaining communities, particularly on the mental side. And I am going to speak a little bit about conflict within community and contrast, conflict, controversy, all those wonderful words that start with C that I think are really important for us to embrace. And I promise no hint towards resolution. I simply like to embrace the conflict for what it is. And on that note, Ethan and I will be talking sort of back and forth a little bit. So yeah, go at it. I'll cut you off if I feel like I need to say something.
Yes, please do. So I was actually shocked this week to actually, I had this impression of what I was supposed to talk about, and I looked at the website, and I was like, oh my God, I'm supposed to talk about that. And so what the website said was that I'm going to speak on what brings us together and how communities such as ours are formed and grow. And I'm going to focus in the beginning on what brings us together, because I think that's kind of near and dear to my heart. And I think I was asking myself, you know, after I've been kicking around here for as long as I have, and, you know, kind of feeling at times like I'm on the backside of my rave throwing experience and whatnot, what do I actually, you know, kind of feel like I have to share to a group that might be of value? And the things that still turn me on about throwing parties, and that in the course of throwing a party or building community, because to me throwing a party has always been an exercise in building community, is really kind of just trying to guide the energy and get it all to a good place. So to me, when I ask, say, what's the whole point in commuting, what's the whole point in doing this, you know, the kind of the original magic that I referred to as perceiving and seeing in party throwing way back when was this discovery of this magic possibility to take a bunch of people's positive energy and good intention and put it all together and create a totally transformed space where people felt like they could be themselves with each other. And the sight of seeing, you know, a bunch of sweaty, dusty, dirty freaks dancing at 7 in the morning, they're completely, you know, there's no pretense anymore. There's no games going on. You've danced yourself out of yourself, and you're really being yourself with each other. And the ability to create spaces like that where people were feeling free and they were dancing themselves out of the pain and the grief and the loss that everybody experiences day to day around family members, around relationships, around sickness, that these environments are fundamentally healing, positive environments, and the creation of them as a conscious act, not just on the part of the producers, but on the people that come and help build them, is a profound activity. And so it's super important to me as someone that tries to facilitate events, and also as something that I want to convey to the people that are at those events, that the active, conscious focus of mental energy on creating a positive space is just a totally kind of key aspect of it. You know, the magic only works if you actually believe that it will work and you believe in it. So, one of the things I ask myself about events is how really do you measure success? And I don't think you can measure success in regards to events if you're not kind of clear on what your goals are. And one of my goals with throwing parties was always to build community. And so when you ask yourself, how do I measure the success of whether I've built community, or how do I evaluate this particular event, that's kind of an interesting question to ask, and the answer has changed over time. And especially in the context of a group of people that's trying to work together to produce them, I find myself feeling like I'm not asking myself questions like, you know, were the DJs good? Did we get all the cars parked right? Although those are really important. But, you know, how was the energy? You know, did we produce harmony? Was it satisfying for people? Are we smiling? Things like that along the way. And it's really interesting to me because those things point up to me that there's like that certain kind of very natural things in life, like beauty and elegance and harmony, as contrasted with discord and anger and strife and conflict, are really kind of primary goals for me and for these events, and even for trying to throw these events. And so trying to guide that energy and actually get through an event, get through planning meetings, throw the party, and have it have been a positive experience for everyone is really kind of how I try and measure success in that regard. And so, you know, I like to encourage people, both as event planners and as an event attendees, to really kind of stop and do something to really get themselves conscious about what they're doing with their energy. And that's kind of the point of the ritual aspect that I've tried to bring to friends and family, and I'm excited there's a panel on this later, is that to me it's really not about a particular brand of spirituality or any particular religious discipline. It's just about saying, let us all stop right here and pause together and acknowledge and recognize and focus our mental, positive, emotional energy on creating something that is special and healing for all of us. So it seems to me at times subtle, but just adding that level of awareness to the fact that we're trying to build something that meets our needs and is a place for us to be, that represents a home and a sense of family and a place that we feel like we are accepted as who we are, is an essential and perhaps fundamental aspect of this activity.
If you don't mind, that would be a good point for me to interject one of the points that I wanted to make. When you do have any group of people trying to do something together, even a group of incredibly capable, incredibly articulate, positive people with clearly stated intentions of what they are trying to do together, inevitably somewhere along the line some type of conflict can arise and probably will, if not in any one particular event. If you do it over and over again, sooner or later it will. Part of this is, no matter how well we agree on what it is we're doing together. Words and actions are not the same thing. They live in an entirely different universe from each other. And those two dimensions can impact each other. The reason we bother getting up here and sharing words with a group of people like this is because the words can impact what we do, and what we do can impact the words we say, but those are not the same thing. And it's very important to recognize, particularly when things start getting tense, it doesn't really matter what words are said. That dimension is less tangible than the dimension of what happens. Pay very close attention to what impact the words have, how they affect the actions of yourself and the people around you is much more important than what you see the content of the words as. And to that respect, a group of people that don't technically agree on what they're trying to do together can still succeed in doing something together, whereas a group of people that do agree on what they're trying to do together can still fail on doing that thing, because it's what happens when those people are together trying to do whatever it is that gets done in the end that matters more than the words that are said. And turn it back over to your stories.
All right. So I wanted to move on to just a little discussion of how communities are actually formed. I was amazed over, you know, the course of years in FNF at being approached over and over and over again and saying, by people saying, how do I become part of FNF? What do I do? You know, like, where do I sign up? And, you know, is there a registration fee? And things like that. And I don't, maybe it was naive of me to be surprised, but the answer was always, well, just, you know, show up, come to a playing meeting or come to the next event and you know, hang out with us and get to know people and then just get involved. And people are uniformly surprised at that being the answer. So the perception that left me with is that for communities to expand and grow and actually kind of gel and get formed, you really need to provide touch points, and you have to provide access, and actually providing information through the network of people or through whatever, you know, if you have websites or whatever it is that you do, that if in fact this is true for your community, and it might not, that growth is welcome, that new bodies are welcome, that new people are welcome. Actually, just providing easy access is a good way to help communities form. One of the things that I've really been impressed with about what Cloud Factory has been doing in diversifying kind of beyond dance parties and whatnot, which is just so essential for communities to grow, is just to create opportunities for the expression of talent. There's so much, you know, diverse talent in these communities that really, you know, saying, okay, you know, what kind of new events and forums can we create? You know, the Ode event in Oregon that Cloud Factory does every spring just never ceases to amaze me. I mean, you know, 70s dance reviews, you know, impromptu theater, poetry. So I think what helps communities form is also being a place for talent and creativity to express itself. And as the community, looking for new ways to provide foundations and support for that, like this, like the fashion shows, like new humor. It's all fantastic. At the same time, also providing new opportunities for people to do things they haven't done. So being in one place, a place, you know, an opportunity for you to do what you're really good at, and simultaneously being an opportunity for you to do something that you've never done before. There have been at times, I haven't really seen this take off too much, but ideas about, you know, seminars on lighting or on sound. So if you've always wondered how those amplifiers and crossovers and speakers work, that there's certainly plenty of people around that can show you, and you can you know, take on new skills and whatnot. But also, this, you know, and one of the things that's been really great about FNF and about kind of, you know, some of the stuff Glue was talking about with staffing, with site coordinators and whatnot, is seeing people that didn't think of themselves as you know, occupying leadership roles before taking on big chunks of responsibility and just kicking the shit out of them. It's always a tremendously satisfying experience to see a new site coordinator, you know, kind of take on that role and just really do great at it. I've been so, you know, amazed a couple of times that, especially, you know, as someone who kind of ultimately, you know, has to report back to the space owners or whatnot and whatnot, having you know, a new person that will take on some chunk of responsibility and simply handle it, so you don't have to think about it. And you know, everybody that worked with them and worked for them or whatever really enjoyed themselves is tremendous. So I think communities are helped to form and grow as people are given new areas of responsibility and support in developing that. Obviously, what helps communities develop is the actual practice of doing events, all kinds of events. I've always felt like more so, even though we put all this energy into actually throwing parties and the experience of the party is fun, that I always felt like the relationships and the trust and the kind of the sense of dependability that I got from people always came before the party and after party. In longer format parties like weekends, there's more duration, so those issues come into play, you know, during the course of an event. But it's you know, who you work with when you're cleaning up the space before and when you're putting the gear away after, and trying to, you know, return the space to the person who lives in that warehouse, you know, clean such that they have a clean house the next morning and whatnot, you know, are really, really where you start to, you know, kind of form those relationships. Also, just an awareness and an acceptance of the natural ebb and flow of things. It's been really interesting to observe friends and family over the years, because the group is always, you know, changing and morphing, and people are coming and people are going, and the crew that comes together to throw any party at any given time is simply that collection of people that has the time and the energy and the enthusiasm at that moment to actually make it happen. So that kind of flexibility to work with what you've got and assemble that particular aggregation of talents at that time has always been useful as well. I wanted to return to the question of leadership that was brought up early. You know, Friends and Family, for about 5 or 6 years now, really has not done much more than throw a yearly camp out. You know, we'll opportunistically throw a party here and there if a space comes up. But there's this tremendous, you know, history together. There's all this trust that's been built. There's this amazing set of skills. There's an amazing set of infrastructure and equipment and et cetera and et cetera. And there's also all this kind of history and tradition about how meetings are run and how process or whatnot. And it would be really a good thing if there was more distributed leadership throughout our group, such that anybody could really pick up the reins and get that whole machine going if they wanted to. And there's really no reason that anybody couldn't, other than I think perhaps some trepidation about kind of, you know, can I really turn the key and start that engine and whatnot. And yet, you know, through we see in other areas like site coordination and things like that, there's certainly plenty of people that have the kind of the set of skills and kind of, you know, just leadership potential, if you will. But so as an organization, I think Friends and Family would be benefited by actually cultivating and developing in people the awareness that, yeah, here's the keys. These people know you. You know, we've all done it before. I mean, FNF as an organization certainly has got so much organizational experience that it's really, I mean, the parties kind of throw themselves. It's really just about someone, you know, getting up and saying, okay, here we go, let's go do it. So and I also think that there kind of ends up being a sense, and I know this is true for Friends and Family, but I've sensed it in other organizations as well. I think that there's that kind of throwing an event is this kind of pinnacle that you have to reach and you have to ascend, and that there's certain kind of bars you have to hit in terms of it being worthy and being a true expression of all your potential and whatnot. And the height of that bar and wanting to do it so well and so right actually kind of precludes a fair amount of kind of lower level expression, because you don't want to spin up the whole machine, or the space isn't quite big enough for this and that. So I think one thing that would be really good too, which kind of fits I think nicely with the idea of distributed leadership, is and also works with the idea that the party throwing group is just what it coalesces into at any given moment, is just for much smaller, kind of more impromptu events where whoever, you know, kind of has the time or energy says, hey, here's this opportunity, let's do it, you know, who wants to go do it? And whatever kind of group of people, you know, responds to that call goes and produces an event. And it benefits from all the history and other benefits that you've accrued as a group over time, but doesn't have to necessarily kind of, you know, be that that big thing.
If you don't mind my interjection again, I think one of the things that really holds some people back from attempting leadership or trying to step into areas larger than what they find themselves comfortable in is, I mean, the rather predictable fear of failure. But in communities like ours, where there's so much drive for novelty and appreciation of unpredictability, and so much to be learned from new things in general, failure is, like conflict, is one of our most valuable experiences. And it's really the people that I've seen that have stepped up into positions of high responsibility are not the people that have avoided failure over the years, but the people who, when they see it happening, when they know that they've made a mistake, they don't step back down and say, okay, I'm not actually as capable as I thought I was. They say, okay, I'm not as capable as I thought I was. I better try again. And I better find a way to make up for what just went wrong because of my actions. And there's something really beautiful in the adaptability of seeing an individual or a group of people find themselves in this bed that they've made for themselves that is not as comfortable as the place they'd like to sleep. And instead of spending the rest of the night tossing and turning and groaning about it not being so comfortable, we'll go ahead and try to remake the bed right then and there at 3 in the morning instead of going to sleep until they get it to a point where they're comfortable lying down in it. And that's a... there's the experiences that I've had doing that, making mistakes and coming back to revisit them, even in parent event for Storm Sessions, a gathering of the tribes that's happened for 3 years now. Every year it feels like the scheduling for the event is one constant crisis. It's like we actually, like, workshop by workshop, panel by panel, is realizing what we haven't yet gotten together that needs to have happened half an hour ago, and finding some way to pull it off so that it's still enjoyable for the participants takes a minimal amount of apologizing on our part and continues to include at the end of the day everything that we had planned for the day. And it's frightening. There's some experience of straight up free fall, jump off the cliff, worried about when that ground is going to come up in our face and everything will be over. But then at the end of the day, it does work out. Everyone is happy. You get enough nods that you realize all that crisis was all up in our heads, and we needed it in order to take one step and after the other and get done what needed to get done that day. But it wasn't actually failure. As much as we probably could have done a much better job organizing and a much better, put a lot more effort into not feeling like we were about to completely fail at any given moment, that the quality of that experience is what gives our events some of the magic that they have. And that's essentially what being adaptable is. You put your hand on the oven, you realize, or the stove top, you realize it's hot, you pull it back. If you do it over and over again, you're not adapting. If you do it once, and then you go on trying to put your hand somewhere else to get done what you need to get done, then that's displaying adaptability and growth.
I was pretty much done with my organized thoughts, but, you know, one thing... Sorry. That's a good question. I guess, you know, to further refine that, I mean, I Friends Family is a website, but it hasn't been updated in 5 years. Although, Seriously, it's a historical document. But it still does contain links that actually forward to someone. I guess I would try and add detail to that by saying it may just be kind of a cultural characteristic of the group that makes sure the organization itself knows that anybody really can be a touch within the organization can be a touch point and say, yes, you can get involved. You can get involved right now by helping me hang this light, or you can get involved by, joining one of our email lists. I think people have actually been fairly shocked, and I've gotten a little feedback, that it at times too easy to get on our planners list, especially that, sensitive things get discussed there and whatnot. But for the most part, if someone's wanting to get involved, say, yeah, get on our planners list and just get involved. So in terms of actual touch points, in terms of, websites or whatnot, there may not be stuff like that, but I think just having the sense throughout the organization that people are welcome and that everybody that, that represents the organization at an event is a touch point for becoming involved and puts out that kind of welcoming hand and says, yeah, get involved, is probably what I mean.
I definitely want to emphasize that, you have to get people, you have to get new people involved. If you don't get new people involved, and if you don't cultivate and actively seek out diversity, you're sort of the inevitable conclusion, I think, is the room full of jaded fucks, of people who, I've seen it all, and, nothing's new, and, blah, blah, blah. And it can be real easy to, take that, new, shining, excited, passionate face and somebody who wants to do something and they don't know what they want to do, but they just want to contribute and get involved because, God, you guys are all so cool and what you do is, really cool. And it's like, well, I don't know right now, but, come back later. Or, maybe you could join our email list. And it's not sticky enough. It doesn't provide a place for people to land and for people to stick and for the group to take whatever it is that you have no idea that person may be able to offer to the group and to grow the group and to keep it alive. Because if you don't have new, and this is something that I feel like that a number of the groups that I'm involved with are really going through right now is a lack of new people and a lack of new, it doesn't have anything to do with leadership. It's the base. It's not the top. We've got friends and family have some great leaders and great people on the top, but if you don't have new people coming in that push, it's often the new people that push, I want to have a fucking party. Can we have a party? When we want to do something, and it pushes people to do stuff that they may not have had, had the ability to do. Or, yeah.
I have a question. We were talking about the meritocracy, and I wanted you to speak more to the formal and informal ways that mentoring goes.
I tried to build in mentoring to some of the structural aspects of namely the staffing sheet. For the larger parties, we not only have site coordinators, but we have site coordinator assistants, especially for the Camp and Sons camp out or stuff that generally is more than 600 people or so. Because if something happens and the site coordinator needs to be kept free to do whatever it is they need to do, and we found it quite useful for the site coordinator to have somebody that they can their gopher. But what that also provides, and which we specifically implemented for that reason, is that it gives the site coordinator assistant ultimately the chance to be a site coordinator because they get battle tested essentially, and they see what goes on and how it happens. Also, the way that coordinators deal with the staff that they have. If you are on the food committee or the will call list for 1 or 2 years, you basically know. Well, especially for something as functional as door or will call, you basically know what it involves. It's not rocket science. But you can step up to the plate, and as long as we've seen you at the will call a couple times, or you have you know, you've been doing it for a while somewhere else, or just show the passion to do it, you know, you can step up to do that. And another thing that's very important, I think, for mentorship is job definitions, and that's something I've also tried to work into staffing sheets, is specifically defining, you know, well, what is the door coordinator? What does the parking coordinator do? So that somebody who hasn't done it before but has been, you know, on parking team, but may not have been aware of all of the intricacies of it, which there aren't a whole lot, but, you know, can actually read something and go, okay, so I'm responsible for this and blah, blah, blah. Okay, great, so I can do it. And then there's other... Yeah, so it's just, I think it is mentorship and actively trying to provide a structure and a framework to provide for mentorship. And I think that, again, that starts with intent. The group has to, somebody has to be thinking about that and encouraging it. So from square one.
There's a woman that I was speaking to a couple of years ago who, it's not exactly mentorship because she was taking her own initiative to learn what it was she was doing, but she was taking over the kitchen for the Church of Mez at Burning Man this year, and she'd never done that before. And I don't know how many of you have gone to the Church of Mez site at Burning Man, but they're a fairly large crew of people, and they do a lot of communal eating together. So the kitchen that at their camp is an elaborate thing to organize, and she'd never done it before, and I was so inspired by the way she was describing her process around getting ready for this. She went to each person who'd done it the year before and asked them what had gone wrong, and she was telling me not because she wanted to have nothing go wrong this year. She's like, I'm going to be cooking for some 30 people for a week straight in the middle of the desert. It's going to be a bloody disaster by the time everything's over. I just want to make sure that my disaster has never happened before. And it's I'm not sure exactly how, but it's something we could perhaps turn on its head in thinking about mentoring and encourage the people who are coming up as newer leaders or mentors into specific positions, and not to look to me from the voice of the person that is mentoring them, not to look to me for how to do this job right, and not to look to me to like necessarily what to how to not screw up in doing this job, but learn from my mistakes so that your mistakes take it to the next level. And so that think of the person after you will have that much more mistakes to learn from before they step into the position.
And this is also where permanence in the community comes in again, is that there are people who've done it in the past that are still around and that are, they may not have the time to do it this year, but they have the time to talk to you. And the community can provide people that are interested in doing a novel task with the tools and with the people and with the advice that they need to be successful.
Any more questions people have to throw out at us?
Scott's over there waving his hand.
Oh.
I have a comment on like new membership sort of questions or issues. I think one of the most difficult challenges of groups like Project any group that's very tight and close is that those groups are made up of very close groups of friends, or generally started in very close groups of friends, or end up in very close groups of friends. It's not so easy to just walk into a group of 10 people who know each other really well and just do something. It's not quite that easy. I don't really know what the answer to that is. One of my ideas is sort of corollary of Ethan's idea about training, not necessarily training, but creating more leaders. It's sort of spawning different groups. And it's happened a little bit in our community. So we have vibration trying to spawn from us. There's a kind of an group that spawned for a little while and was writing on the wall. So there's different groups that have sort of popped up, but I think if that could be somehow accelerated or encouraged in mind, that you would end up with a group of lots of small people. Because there is also this sort of question of how large can the community grow.
I also think that that's really hard because one of the things that I've noticed is that when a new person comes up and says, I want to get involved and I want to contribute, what they're really saying is, I want to be close with you. You know, I want to be your friend. I see this incredible tight-knit group of people. How do I be tight-knit with you? And that's not something that is just, okay, you're tight-knit, clink. You know, it's like, well, if you show up at the next party and you do stuff, and it takes time. And I think that part of it is probably managing those expectations that, you know, this isn't just a quick snap, you know, you're involved, but it really comes from within. It comes from within you. If you are inside feeling like you're contributing and you're making a difference, then you're more likely to come to the next party. And other people within the group who are already a lot more tight-knit can contribute, can, you know, either make that more successful or not by, I don't know, I remember Larry Harvey once said something to the effect that it's a very fine line between joining hands with a group of people and coming together, but then having that group of joined hands keeping people out. So it's just it's a fine line, but to be intentful of that line.
I also think, though, that there are cases where people can just step right in and succeed, and that actually, if a goal of your organization is to try and you know, be modular so that people can effectively plug in and succeed, is really good. An example of this at our last campout, we had, you know, someone that wanted to take on the enormous task of leading the food effort, and they brought with them this guy Chris, who I guess was an army cook before, and this guy loved to cook, and he loved to cook for lots and lots of people. It was his thing, you know. And not only was he involved in every meal for the entire weekend, but he played saxophone in between, you know, prepping and stuff. And he was incredible. And I've never actually seen someone completely. We'd never seen him before. He came. He plugged in. He kicked ass. He had a great time, you know. And he cleaned up when he was done, and smiled the whole way. I was completely amazed by the guy, and I think he felt right at home. So I actually considered that a kind of a success in kind of being modular and welcoming and able to provide a platform for, you know, for.
Right, and this was to a group that had known each other for years and was already very tight-knit. And right. Yeah. Exactly. I believe it was Ethan who was talking earlier in his speech that, you know, the leadership has to do with identifying something that needs to be done and just doing it. That's what this particular individual. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, and that's what this individual did with the food. You know, there was a need for somebody to do the food, and he was an expert at it, and he kicked ass and did it. There was a need for a staffing coordinator that nobody wanted to do because it was the shit job, and everyone hated it. But I was like, you know, I did some project management stuff, and I was like, I'd love to do it. I want to do it. So I came in, and I like, and they didn't know who I was. I was a faceless entity for about 3 months. So, like, and I basically did all the staffing for a New Year's Eve party, and then I showed up, and we were like, oh, that's Ghoulie, you know. And so there are very good examples of the ability to come in and kick ass and make a great impression on people. But I guess the caveat is that it's much more difficult to do that in the sexier things where there's already three people that are good at doing that and like to do it and are going to be doing it again. JD?
And actually, there's one hand up a little longer than JD, and there's about 10 minutes left before a few announcements will begin lunch. So if you don't mind holding on a sec, JD, go for it. Hey, follow what works. Thanks. Shoot, JD.
Didn't have a choice.
Good point. Actually, knowing what to do with volunteers can really be a challenge. You feel kind of stupid when you put out the call for, you know, massive help, and then there's all these people sitting around going, "Okay, here I am. What the hell do I do with at the Noah Knight benefit? Friends of mine did at SOMAR. It's huge. You know, three just colossal space. You know, and there were points during that afternoon when people were showing up, and you know, there's a room twice the size. You know, and some scissor lifts sitting around and actually kind of being, you know, being prepared to put people to work, which is where it kind of gets back to, you know, looking around, trying to see what needs to be done. And it can be, it really is an education job there, because even things that are seemingly obvious, like, okay, those coils, cables need to be coiled rather, you know, or we need to sweep or stuff. There's just the, you know, new people really don't necessarily have at all. They're just the kind of, they're not looking at this empty room or this needing to be filled room and seeing what you're seeing. So I think that could actually be, you know, formalizing that pre-party, saying, okay, exactly what can we put volunteers on as they arrive, and maybe even having a volunteer coordinator.
Right, and I'm a big fan of, like, creating, you know, I like creating new coordinator positions, not for the sake of just creating it, but if you run it, if you have a dynamic group and you have more people that want to get involved than you currently have things to do, you usually can, like, I will actively try and make things for people to do. So, you know, maybe another, you know, maybe a position that could be created is the on-site volunteer coordinator. And they, because the problem with a lot of newbies is they don't, you know who your coordinators are, but they don't. They're new. They don't know who JD or Ethan or Dave is. But if they knew a single person to go to and who was sort of the clearinghouse for, like, okay, like, here's all the things that need to be done on site, you know, then that's a, you know, something that could happen.
That's a problem really common to nonprofit organizations that go well beyond the party scene, too. If you don't know what to do with a volunteer, then it's very difficult to... It takes a lot of work to manage volunteers, even though volunteers are really free work for your organization. And that's something worth putting effort into working out, doing well. Now, you had your hand up for a while here.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, I think that machine was an unfortunate choice of words, perhaps. But there is nonetheless this sense, I think, in me and others, that there's just all this potential sitting around that no one's really actualizing as much as we could. And that kind of diversifying the base of people that felt comfortable actualizing and marshaling. I really feel potential is a good word, because the group energy is there, because as soon as you someone marshals it, it's just there. It's, you know, I mean... No, I mean that it's people believing and being ready to follow that someone and feeling like they're going to deliver on the promise of organizing and whatnot. And that's what I feel like we need to cultivate. But the opportunity is there for so many people within the group. And I think it's just getting people comfortable with being able to kind of take the reins, if you will. Because I really feel like, you know, that the energy is there, and the infrastructure is there, and really we just need to develop, you know, a few more people that are, you know, confident in leading the charge, really.
I'm going to have to make this a last question before we really seriously dig into our lunch efforts. I saw your hand as a awfully eager one. Questions? Okay, thanks everybody. I'm just going to turn it over to Scott for some pre-lunch announcements after you all applaud us gregariously.
So just a couple brief things. If anyone wants to smoke cigarettes or anything else, the right where Brian's standing there in the back, through there, there's a room, big room with a roll-up door. That is the smoking room. Let's see, there's for people who are staying this afternoon and wanting to stay in the area over here in Oakland, there's a list of restaurants and a map of where we are over here by the chai that Melissa prepared for us. So if you want to leave at 6 and come back at 8 for the lounge after party, you can. There's some ideas on where to go out to eat. Lunch is being served in here, it looks like. Lunch is $5. A lot of you, most of you who want it, have already prepaid with your registration. If you haven't paid or want to pay, just give your money to one of us, or at the registration booth or something. It'll be kind of free form. It's falafel, tabbouleh salad. Where's Megan or Peyton? Is all of it vegan or most of it vegan? Everything except for the pesto is vegan. So.
Except for the pesto?
and also we have some friends from Share, which is, do you want to talk about it for a second? Okay. Do you want to just tell them what Share is? There's a booth.
Yeah. Okay. Who wants to share?
So, hi, I'm Ian. We're here from Share Project, which is the Bay Area chapter of DanceSafe. Does anybody here not know what DanceSafe is?
No.
Okay. So, we've got a booth set up. We have, you know, literature, earplugs, condoms, stuff like that. It's free. Presumably, you won't need earplugs here, but you can take them with you. I don't know. There's not really much else to say. We don't have testing kits right now, but I'm going to try and get some today.
Okay, and so in the afternoon at 2, we're going to be splitting into two rooms. There's a room over there with the sound system. So around 2, we'll come around and tell everyone, but we're running about 5 or 10 minutes behind. So 2:10, 2:15, we'll get everyone back together. The sessions at 2 are... Feed Your Head, which is a series of short presentations describing projects and artistic endeavors that have grown out of the electronic dance communities. Melissa, Brandon, Leah Roderman from Nonchalance and Joel Fuller will be speaking. Joel is actually with a group called Plebeian Productions, and I think we're going to show his documentary in one room. Where's Curly? In one of the two rooms, we're going to show a documentary called Deviant Rhythms in the other room. And then this next session is the other session in this room, I think. This room A? Is called Plug In, Turn On, which is going to be by Brian Ballendorf, Cliff Skolnick, and a little bit by me, possibly, just talking about electronic organizing, electronic communities, open source communities, how they relate to the dance communities, since there's a lot of crossover in our groups. So thank you very much.